So I've got a mic on attached to me, and we've got portable microphones for the others once we get going on the discussion. As you all know, over the years, several funding approaches have been developed to support long-term research. Many organizations throughout the world support research carried out within small teams around a principal investigator. This approach is seen most frequently in the context of curiosity-driven research in universities without preset topics. And by its nature, it usually relates to a specific scientific discipline. The alternative for certain scientific challenges is to set up an inspiring goal that drives a large federated research effort over a long period of time aimed at making a major impact. We saw some potential candidates just now. Other extreme examples include the Human Genome Project, Large Hadron Collider at CERN, and so on. FET itself funds collaborative research, often of a multidisciplinary nature, carried out by international consortia. And this is achieved through a combination of two complementary schemes, and I'm going to mention them now because we're not having the chat about them. FET Open supports small and medium-sized projects pushing towards new horizons for ICT. It allows proposals on any pertinent topic to be submitted at any time. FET Proactive supports clusters of research projects around a number of identified long-term challenges in ICT in order to create a specific impact in selected areas. And now, as we've heard, FET is going one step further by addressing grand scientific challenges with the new concept of FET flagships. These will federate national and EU efforts on a grand scale, creating sustained support, which Nelly Cruz said would amount to €1 billion over a decade. The grand scientific challenges of the FET flagships have been established through competition within the scientific community to identify the best ideas. But such long-term dedicated initiatives have to be balanced and complemented with an open approach to research funding, which can rapidly accommodate new ideas and emerging trends. And this panel, getting down to business, will discuss how these two ways of funding can complement each other and enhance each other. So first of all, I'm going to ask our six panelists to introduce themselves very briefly, not to make an opening statement, just to give us their affiliation and their background, which will enable you to sort of put their forthcoming remarks into context. And first of all, we have Jacques Stern, who is currently policy advisor to Madame Pécresse, the French Minister for Science and Higher Education. Tell us a little bit about where you're coming from on this. Yes.
Okay, so just a few words to mention that I'm a policy advisor, but before that, I was a scientist working in computer science. My area was cryptography, and then I moved to governance. I became chairman of a listed company that manufactures payment terminals. Then I was the chair of the National Agency for Research, and now I'm advising the French Minister for Research.
And next we have Robert Madeleine, who's Director General for Information Society and Media in the European Commission.
Thanks. So the short description of what I do is I do what Nelly tells me to do. Second complication, I'm not a scientist, but there are several hundred of very good scientists cooperating with us both within the DG and, of course, then across the whole of Europe.
Thank you. Norbert Crewe is a member of the Council of Scientists for the European Research Council and he's vice president of the Hungarian Academy of Sciences.
And in addition, a physicist who is working somewhere on the borderline between condensed matter physics and optics, mainly quantum optics, and I'm responsible for the Hungarian Research Infrastructure Program, and I used to chair a similar program in the Commission.
Thank you very much. And then turning to my left, we have Paul ter Hoorn from the University of Eindhoven and former chairman of the Advisory Council of the Netherlands ICT Research and Innovation Authority.
Yes, thank you. The sound is quite awful, to be honest, for us. Hopefully not for the meeting room. Well, as you introduced me already, I have been quite active in ICT research policy making in the Netherlands the last few years. And currently, my current assignment is to set up an institute on the Technical University in Eindhoven, the University of Technology in Eindhoven, which combines or integrates all ICT research, which is apparently distributed in several faculties today. My background is industrial. I worked for a long time for the Dutch telecom operator, KPN, and I had a couple of years of a very interesting job at Lucent Technologies in the European branch.
Thank you very much. Now, Jerzy Lange, who is Foreign Secretary of the Academia Europea.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm a physicist by training, by my profession, in condensed matter, similar like Norbert Crewe, and he's also a member of Academia Europea. And my contact with this audience is because I was a member of ESTAG a couple of years ago, and was also a member of Europe, but also was a member of the Polish government some time ago. And if I could say in one sentence what was my largest achievement in terms of a policy, not only fighting for the ERC, but changing the opinion of the whole government of Poland, because at one moment the minister had to veto the ERC, and it took me 10 minutes at the Council of Ministers of Poland to change the opinion of the most positive. So this is exactly what I'm very proud of.
Well done. And our last panelist is Paul Verschure from the University of Pompei Fabra and from ICREA.
Thank you. So I'm a psychologist by training, and I felt uneasy in psychology because I felt that we had to build more models of psychological phenomena. For that reason, I moved to artificial intelligence, where I spent some time. And then in artificial intelligence, again, I was sort of unhappy because I felt a lack of grounding in reality. So then I moved more toward neuroscience, and I spent a lot of time in neuroscience. And now I'm trying to combine these different views and different methods to investigate reality to answer this very fundamental question: how do mind and brain actually relate? And I think one specific aspect that we bring to the table here, it's also on display here in the fair, is that the view we're pushing is very much that it's large integration across many projects that should bring progress here, certainly in the context also of machines. So the philosophy that we follow is very much a machine-based view on reality.
Thank you very much. Well, I'm going to get the discussion going on the up on the stage here, but I'm hoping that we'll soon move on to some stimulating questions from you in the audience. So do have a think about what you'd like us to talk about. But first of all, the overall question here is, what are the advantages and disadvantages of grand scientific challenge-driven initiatives and of the open approach, and how can the two complement each other? What's the right balance? So, Norbert, perhaps you can kick off our discussion. How would you see the balance?
A few years ago, a group of scientists in California made an analysis on the impact on American economy of different type of research activities in the long run, 25 years or so. And it turned out that the largest impact, and since we are speaking about the future, I think this is the important thing, is came from blue sky research. Sometimes it is called basic research. I don't like this expression. So, of course, first of all, a few sentences on this type, which is typically bottom-up research. It is research which is financed mostly by public money, and therefore I think open access to data is a must. The organization which I partly represent, the European Research Council, is working on the basis of this principle. The only selection rule is excellence, and bright ideas are issues which we are happy to support. Now, in connection with that, I would like to mention a strange paradoxical issue. I call it time paradox. In order to get along in our life, we need more and more knowledge, and this requires more and more time to acquire. On the other hand, the obsolescence time of this knowledge is shorter and shorter. So the time factor is getting more and more important. And therefore, how fast a new research result gets into the public is vitally important. That's why the Commission a few years ago picked up the digital library issue, including the open access, and I hope this idea is going to develop further. Of course, there are already instruments which help to overcome this hurdle. Teamwork is one of them, cooperation is another one, and cost sharing is a third one. Now, on the other end of the game is the top-down issue, and of course, global challenges are typical of this type. This is connected, of course, with the applied knowledge, where prioritization is needed, and this prioritization may lead to some selection rules, and in my understanding, grand challenges are the results of such selection rules in Europe. Now, of course, in connection with that, there are some tensions. One of them is a tension between intellectual property right and openness, on the other hand. And the other one is the tension between bottom-up and top-down research. Now, bottom-up is mainly basic research, where funding is mainly led by the scientific community, and this applies to the European Research Council too. On the other hand, in top-down, strategically important issues have to be tackled. Here the priorities are defined by the founders, by the funders, but to select the winners and prescribe solutions in advance is a dangerous issue. It rarely succeeds. Now, to define global challenges and encourage scientists to join it or to correlate their activity with it, I think it is the way where science should develop. And the time paradox, what I mentioned before, is also working in this direction. My third remark in connection with that is that if define the scientific community may find how to connect their activity with it. Now, how to find the proper balance of that? I think this is a question what cannot be answered here, because this is a dynamical issue. It changes from topics to topics, from field to field, and I think the real art of science policy is to find in each case the proper solution. Appropriate decisions may help a lot, and bad decisions may cause a hurdle. Let me mention just one thing from the past. At the turn from the 19th to the 20th century, Argentina and the United States were about on the same level. Maybe Argentina was even better off. In Argentina, they decided to base their economy on beef. In the United States, they decided to base the American economy on innovation. And the result is now clearly seen. I think we should learn from the experience of the past, but we should not forget that we are going to work for the future.
Well, thanks very much. That was a very wise summary of the issues. You introduced the terms top-down and bottom-up, which are almost synonyms for big and small. Let me ask another of our active scientists, Paul Verschuren, for his perspective on this. Top-up, bottom-down, big, small, grand challenges.
Right. Well, in my mind, it's not so much about big or small projects, but it's more about big or small questions. So in science, it all turns around to questions that we pose. And curiously enough, if you look at the pragmatics of science today, we usually address questions that a single brain or small teams of brains can answer. You talk about small teams of one PhD student, maybe a few more, maybe there's a postdoc in there. But this is roughly a constraint for imposing on the kinds of questions we can answer. So there's a big restriction there. So in some sense, we are now living in a science framework that is restricting the questions we can pose. And so in that sense, this is not only because of how funding has developed, and this also this whole idea of specialization of effort in science. It's also this idea that, okay, if we specialize scientific investigation into the pursuit of a lot of small, specific questions, that's the road to progress, right? This is a very reductionist view on reality. And is that really so? If we want to answer big questions, is this the way to do it? Should we sort of, you know, divide and conquer the big problems? Because if you look at it, what are the big problems that humanity is facing? They're not that many, right? If you look at it, what's the origin of the universe? What's the origin of life? What's the origin of mind and consciousness? The rest is all derived from that. Well, these are not the kinds of questions that a single PhD student, a single lab, a single institution can solve. These are questions, if we want to address these questions, we have to pursue them in large-scale, collaborative, integrated efforts. And these questions are much beyond the idea of, okay, let's just collect the data and then magic will happen. No, it won't. This needs integration, it needs theory, it needs hypothesis, it needs a framework. And what's essential about this framework is that we must appreciate that science makes progress through its unpredictability. We cannot predict the future. Science has made great discoveries because actually the prophets in the field had it wrong. All right? So we must think about large-scale projects as a vehicle for innovation, for variability, for creativity. So that means we can't think about large projects answering large questions, but we have to think about them in inclusive terms. How can we make sure that this next generation of scientists who are really going to make the breakthroughs, who are now PhD students and postdocs, how can we assure that these people will have the impact they should be having 5, 6, 7, 8 years from now? Because that's where the future is. So in my mind, it's not about big projects or small projects, it's about big questions. Big questions, of course, in some sense need big projects like a flagship project, but that's not enough. It needs a philosophy and a framework that also pays homage to the realities of science, the role of creativity, and the role of surprise.
Thank you very much. I'd like to move down the row now and ask Jerzy Langer to give us his view of the balance.
Thank you very much. Before I try to very briefly answer that question, I'd like to make a very simple experiment with you. Each of you are counting your money every month, at least your spouse is doing that. And of course, these days, the ministers of science, exactly to say minister of finances of Europe, are counting their purses and looking how much money for research. This simple experiment is as follows. I took the Hungarian notes. 1,000, which from yesterday experience is enough to have 3 tickets for the public transportation. If you buy a ticket in the hotel, perhaps it's a little bit cheaper outside. That's all right. So this money, 5 banknotes, represents fictitiously all money which is being spent in Europe from budgets. Not all money, but budgets. State budget, the community budgets for research. And my question is to you, how much of this is the money spent in the countries and how much money has the Commission? Okay, 10 years ago, the Commission was the coin which was enough to buy a ticket for a senior citizen here in Hungary. Today, if we add the new approach, which means the framework plus the cohesion funds, it comes to about 140 billion, this is still the plan, 140 billion euro for the perspective, which means that out of these five banknotes, one is the Commission. What did that mean? Point number one, the fuel is there. Point number two is that the Commission is not any longer a petty player. The Commission will become the strongest budgetary player in Europe. And for me, as a researcher, it means enormous responsibility to act at the Brussels level. So this is the message number one. If we have this information in our head, that's very easy then to answer the question, what is more important, small or big. And my academy, in response to the Commission calls, proposed the following very simple picture of the future spending at the European level. Just three strands. One is grand challenges, you can call it flagships, which means top down. The second one is go to stars, individual in small groups, which means ideas. The third one, help the member states do something that they cannot do alone. And more or less in proportion, one to one. And this is the first part of the answer to the major question. How much and what is the proportion? The second point is, okay, how about this flagships versus open? I don't want to talk about flagships, I love it, but I really love much more the bottom-up, not only because I'm researchers, but the point is that this is the way the civilization, the science developed over a couple of hundred years, and it will not change at all. And a couple of years ago, when I was a member of ESTAC, which was at that time completely dominated by industry, I discovered the FET Open. And there I found this is impossible, it's unthinkable. Everybody talks about Brussels, that this is so full of bureaucracy, whatever. And now comes the guy who says, all right, give me on one page almost your proposal. Within short time you get an answer and money, and it will go. No string attached. And it stays the same until today. So you, my dear Commission, have a jewel. Brilliant, or whatever you name you have. But my question is, why is it so small? We have now European Research Council, which finances basic research from the Commission level. The FET Open, this fantastic, you can add flagship, this is the size of just one or two panels of the ERC. So I think, giving this first exercise, the most important right now is to be courageous. Stop talking millions. Start talking billions. If we want to shoot the star, if we want to match America and Asia, we have to go billions. Completely new financial perspective. And then the final proposal and a comment. Why not to dream even more? Because the FET Open or the other FET, all of them, they are about ingenuity, but the end is the device. What we can get in our shops, or let's say something very practically, as I perceive it. And the point is that at this very moment, what we have? We have European Research Council. We have the very beginning of the European Institute of Technology, which is about the education. But this is the one last step which has to be taken. How about European Innovation Council, which will act as a grand FET for Europe, not only in ICT, but in other disciplines? And think about such a construction. You have a lot of money, and I think that this is possible to spend it much wiser than it used to be, and one of the options is to enlarge FET to something that all Europe would understand, it will be in a European Innovation Council. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll ask Robert Madeline to respond to some of those ideas in a moment. But first of all, let's hear from Paul Tone whether he's happy with I love bottoms up.
Well, let me approach it from a different direction. I believe that we need, as ICT researchers and as ICT community new messages to come across. I experienced the last couple of years trying to get more money for ICT research in my country that it's very difficult to explain how important ICT is, or I should say how important ICT research is, because most of politicians and people that have the strings of the purse do understand and do not. Of course, Paul, you're right, ICT is important, it's everywhere and we use it every day. But they don't see that to get progress, to get innovation, it's not enough to apply ICT as a kind of a servant into other disciplines or into products and services, but you have to develop ICT by itself. And what I believe is that we as an ICT community miss messages, or messages like, for example, in physics, the physicists can always claim what we try to do in our research is to explain how the world is functioning, or the astronomers have the strong message, we are doing research to the origin of ourselves, of humankind. The life science people say, well, our research is leading to is a longer and healthy life. We need messages like that, and in my opinion is that large-scale projects like the flagships help us in delivering these messages to the general public, to politicians, and certainly not least, to potential students. Because another area of worry we have, and I believe that's across Europe, is how do we get young people interested in studying ICT-related subjects and becoming researchers in this area. So the strong idea I have around setting up flagships or setting up large programs is primarily a communication issue. We need these messages to be able to communicate to the general public, to the world, to potential students, to people who have to fund research, what the impact is and how important research is to get that impact. Having said that, it's not just the communication outside to people that have the money available or have to make money available. It's also the communication to other disciplines that ICT is not just something which is there and you only have to talk to an ICT guy to have it applied, or you make a call to a help desk and he helps you out. It's about jointly researching interdisciplinary new challenges, and setting up things like flagships help to do that. Can you only work with large programs and processes and projects? Not at all, because as has been said before, a lot of the developments, the breakthroughs, the boundary-breaking inventions and innovations come from small projects, from persons even that are very dedicated and try to get their own questions answered and follow their own route. The one is not excluding the other. We need them both. And I believe that adding enough large programs together, maintaining FET open type of schemes, is necessary to have long-term focused research, because that's the final issue. I said I have an industry background, and of course from that background, industry always is interested in short-term results. If they fund research very often and even increasingly, they want to have tangible results, applicable results within a few years. But having the messages, as we now discussed today here, for a long time vision, goal-oriented research, having milestones, I believe that helps to get the message across that if you want to have short-term results, you need to invest in long-term goals and long-term milestones.
Thank you, Paul. And maybe Jacques Stern could talk not just about the European scene, but also how nations, in his case, the French government, help to balance the Europe-wide projects.
When I was a researcher, I found the answer to small versus large, very simple. I was in small research, and this was the advantage was in small research I viewed is that you can hop very quickly to new areas, emerging areas of research, and this is what I did because I entered cryptology at the time where it emerged from where it was not before to academia. On the other side, I saw that large programs had the advantage to allow for critical mass, and I believe that policymakers had to do the balance. Now, I'm on the policymaker side, and I find it's much more complicated because I see that large programs, especially if they're built on infrastructures, have a tendency to overspill their budget and then to destroy our ability to fund the light, small, unfocused research. So what I discovered working on these topics, and not only in ICT, with ICT programs, but also with programs in other areas of science, what I discovered is that in order to achieve the balance, you have to build a whole range of tools. You have to start with strategy. And this is what we did. We, in France, we developed a strategic roadmap. I think we didn't invent the wheel. What came out of the roadmap is what came out in other parts of the world. But what was important is that the scientific communities see the process of building this roadmap. So ICT is one of the three major aims that we have in its roadmap. And the two others are energy and environment and health. And then after strategy, we had to develop the tools for fine-tuning and, if I may refer to the excellent talk that we saw, the evolutionary tools. That is, we saw, for example, that we started at Agence Nationale de la Recherche, which I chaired, with having and which is focused on midterm research projects, 2 to 3 years. We started with 30% unfocused research, blue sky research, and 17% focused research. And we saw it was not enough, so we moved to 50%. But more importantly, we tried to reshape the institutions that are working in research in France. We created alliances, that is, we grouped several universities and research institutions that are working on the same subject so that they can align their aims and their objectives in terms of research. And we also develop processes to allocate funding based on the strategic roadmap. That is competitive processes, especially for blue sky research, and processes based on prioritization, especially for long-term research. So at the end of the day, when all this has been built, then it becomes a question of execution, where the fine-tuning can be done year after year using the tools that you have built. Of course, I was asked to focus on the what we do nationwide, but at the European and international level, we also are active, and we believe that open blue sky research can be a building block of larger programs, and larger programs, we believe that they should be widely operated at not only at the nationwide level, but at the European level, because of the need for long-term investments.
Thank you very much. Robert, you're the purest policymaker here. And you're, as you said, the one who hasn't been a scientist. How do you see it?
So, clearly, if you've got enough money, you can have both of everything, is the short answer. But let me start by saying that for me, firstly, small, it doesn't only mean blue sky. Small does not only mean bottom up. You can also have small business-focused innovation. And I think in the Innovation Union vision that the Barroso II Commission has laid out, we are looking for small projects that can be real for citizens and taxpayers, i.e. innovation projects coming out of SMEs, as well as the open, light and fast approach, which can fund speculative, bright ideas at the early stages. So I think that when we're talking about small, we have to be conscious that there are different sorts of small. And fundamentally, I think you can see in the Brussels debate a recognition that although Europe is a sort of big, distant umbrella thing, we must continue to foster support for the small end of research activities, both bottom-up blue sky work and small business-focused, more innovation-oriented work. There are two conditions. The first is that such small activities have to be followed through, and I'm not sure that we're brilliant at that yet. So it's the conditions around that funding which will develop the benefits. We're not very good at connecting the successful small projects to the next steps. And the second part is this concept of connection. We say in FET that the flagships will have a bridging and a crossover mandate, so multidisciplinary and outreach, but that somehow we have to build into also the small end. So small, yes, very important, I would say a growth market, but the conditions for maximizing Europe's benefits from that end of our activities are not yet optimally designed. So that's the big challenge of that end. On the large end, the biggest fear of policymakers from large projects is the same that we've seen recently from large banks. They become too big to fail, and then they fail anyway. So the crucial challenge, I think, to make large projects feasible at a time of budget austerity is actually also that they should be full of follow-through and connectedness. So I would say that in the meetings today and tomorrow where we're thinking about how flagships move from pilots to success, it's not just about the excellent science. I think we've seen that the process so far in Europe has developed some excellent pilots. Will it be possible on pure scientific grounds to tell them apart in a year's time? In a way, I hope not. I hope that the promise of all the pilots continues to prove itself. So the choices of society for the bigger projects will be determined also and perhaps primarily by non-scientific excellence issues. It wasn't by accident that Mr. Kennedy chose the moonshots. He didn't sit there and think, what about that? It came out of a demand to be involved in that work, and it came out of aspirations, and it came out of what the Russians were doing at the time. So what will determine the choices that European society makes? One of the very important points which I hear when I go to the European Parliament is prove to me that the big projects are neither going to squeeze out the small researchers nor ignore the weaker bubbling under institutions around Europe. So I would say if we want more money for big projects, there's a huge onus on those who own the projects at this pilot stage to design the process in such a way that society can see it's for them and people who would otherwise see this as an insider's game can see it's for them, so that all the disciplines feel involved and good researchers, even in the research poor parts of Europe can feel that there's something in it for them. The last point I'd make is a sort of commercial break. Everything gets easier if there's more money. Jerzy illustrated very interestingly what the money is. And in the ICT field, just to put the figures clearly on the table, we spend a bit more than $1 billion a year, and of that we have $100 million a year for FET at the moment, and within that a share for the open, light and fast. We're looking forward to a world where the open, light and fast model becomes generic, so that in the Commons strategic framework it should be everywhere. But the big question that will be debated in the next 6 months is how much money for research. And I think that although this is a FET-focused conference, we have to pull back the focus, and when we go home, we have to continue to advocate strongly for a significantly increased budget for research, with big and small, better designed to bring the science to the societal outcomes quickly.
Yes, because if 100 million is the current FET budget, the flagships would eat it all up at the present level, wouldn't they?
But that's precisely the sort of nightmare, which is it's irrelevant. I mean, 100 million is what we're spending now on FET Open and FET Proactive. By the time we get the piloting phase through, and we start moving towards a vision of, let's hope, two flagships with 100 million as a budget, then we're looking 2013, 14, 15, 16. That becomes possible if, in the meantime, the financial perspectives do what they should do on research. But let's also remember that the 100 million is the envisaged annual budget for a critical mass flagship. It's not all going to come from Nelly's pocket.
No.
So national administrations and players have to also think seriously about this. In other words, a big project has to be broadly shared.
Right. Thank you. After those very interesting initial statements, at least two of the panelists have indicated they want to come back on what others have said. So I'll let them do that before I see if you have any questions. I think, Norbert, you had something you wanted to comment on.
I want to contribute to the discussion on decision-making.
Yes.
My first remark is that the decision-making process in the case of, let us say, blue sky research and large programs is completely different. In the first case, the excellence of the project has to be evaluated, and the guarantee that the person who applies with it can do it, so the excellence of the applicant. And that's it. In the case of large project, it's completely different. There, the decisions have to be made by politics. It's their responsibility. But if they are clever enough, and they should, then they should ask the advice of the scientific community. On the other hand, scientific community should be happy and prepared to do the proper advice, and there the responsibility and danger is that scientists are tempted to oversell and overpromise their project. And this should not be done. And so these two things should be in correlation. And just to give a concrete proposal, which is hanging around, but to my knowledge it hasn't happened yet, I think the Commission, or personally President Barroso, should have a science advisor who can channel the feeling of the scientific community to the decision makers, and the decisions are their philosophy and their needs to the scientific community.
I think one was promised last year, but he or she
has
not yet been appointed. Paul, you had something you wanted to add.
Right. So if I listen to my colleagues here, then it appears that there's a belief there's a contradiction between large and small projects. And I want to argue against that. I don't think this is true. Right. So for instance, think about how we build airplanes nowadays. How does Airbus, how does EADS put an airplane together? Well, actually, you have many, many, many different companies who are providing components of these planes that, again, have their suppliers and so on, and they are all working together towards this one big goal. So it is, in some sense, possible, right? We can overcome these limitations. However, What is required in that case is a plan, a roadmap. Right? So for instance, if I think about a flagship project like the one in which I'm involved, Robot Companions, a very fundamental question there is, how can we assure that small can coexist with large? Right? So the whole point is, the large project gives you guidelines, it identifies roadmaps, it identifies the obstacles of research. Addressing these obstacles, in turn, can become the target of small and medium-sized projects. So these things can coexist. But the big challenge is, to which we actually have no practical answers right now, is how do we get integration? How then do we bring all these answers to these obstacles together in this integrated view for this project on what we call sentient robots? Well, that's then a question of leadership, right? And there, I think scientists are facing fundamental challenges that we have to add. Like, we need leadership that has as its core values also a humility in the face of fundamental questions. Not about thumping our chests, I know now what the future is like. No, because we don't. We need this humility to be able to collaborate and to coordinate across many different projects. We need inclusiveness to support this kind of cooperation. And this is hard for scientists. And Ortega y Gasset in the 1930s already challenged this. He talked about the barbarism of specialization. We are so specialized in seeing single trees. We're not able to see forests collectively. This is what we have to overcome as scientists in big projects. And so therefore, what I see is that we have to now, again, bring back coherence. And I think this leads to the issue of society. To bring coherence in large-scale research, science and technology projects, we have to set ourselves goals that transcend the individual researcher. And that means these are goals that are relevant to society, because we should not forget that it's society that's sponsoring all of this. So what I'm trying to say here is, large and small can coexist. But one of our limiting factors is also the psychology of the researcher of today.
Yes. Yes, you...
I would like to add a small comment, especially to what we've heard from Robert. Quite often, when I talk to, let's say, political people, I say, come on, what is the sense that the Commission deals with small issues? Isn't so that the Commission should deal only with grand issues? And this is not that stupid question. And actually, I think it's a justified question. But the point is, by experience, that the answer must be very positive, that the Commission deals with small subjects, for very simple reason. Take the ERC. The ERC is dealing with small subjects, single persons. But the major change it did on the European scene, it woke up several national councils to revise their policy. Then it was a clear signal to youngsters and the older that they have a chance to go for large sums of money, having a very high recognition, and to be immediately at the center of a stage. So which means a sort of benchmarking and signaling member states, at least some of them, revise your policy. So I think that's enormous effect. So it's not just a matter of, you know, that this is a guy who needs a million, I'll give him a million. No, this is a setting a completely new perspective. And I hope very much that this type of thinking will be prevailing in constructing a new framework. And the argument from very conservative politicians from member states, and especially some Eurohawks who are troubling waters these days, will be taken very seriously. So I see example paving the way, showing that this is another opportunity. So small, it doesn't mean petty. It can be grand at the very end.
Thank you.
I would like to comment on some points of the discussions between small and large. So I heard, exaggerating slightly, I heard issues like, we leave small science to the scientists, and then for large programs, we give it to the policymakers. So my view is slightly different, and I will give you an example of what we did for large programs in France. We launched a program, I mean, the French government launched a program called Investment for the Future, The government borrowed 35 billion euros and decided to allocate the 35 billion euros for investment. This is out of the budget. It's investment and it's one shot. And from the 35 billion euros, 22 billion went to higher education and research. And what we do for our programs, for establishing, for example, technological research institutes, hospital institutes, etc., we gathered international juries with scientists. That is, the policymakers decided to give the end to scientists having designed the project and guidelines. The policymakers gave the end to scientists to choose what were the relevant projects. And I see in the audience some of the members that we gathered, because we in France asked foreign scientists to sit in those committees. And this was a big surprise, because the Prime Minister himself said it's the first time that in France we allocate public money based on the decision of mostly foreign scientists. So I believe scientists have a role to play also in the definition of large-scale programs.
Thank you very much. Now, I promised that I would take a question from the audience, if there is one, and I'm conscious also that it's almost lunchtime. There are at least two people in the front. Do we have a microphone for the gentleman here? She's come, sorry. First you, and then the lady there, and that may be all we have time for. But please make them relevant down this. Please make them relevant to the broad theme of our discussion.
Gentlemen, I enjoyed very much your analysis. May I comment that everything you said was elitist? Of course we are specialists. Let me please just remind you that a few guys out there spent a bit of money, started social computing. The world took it up. It's worth a lot more than the 1 billion that I heard mentioned here. But I also comment that such movements are beginning to change the world, and I don't need to comment on that further. What do you think about how we get out to the world and involve them for all sorts of reasons, please?
That's a good question, and I think it relates to what Paul Tahun was saying at the beginning about inspiring young people to go into this field, because building on what you've just said, I would have thought the way to get people is to say that the broad field of information technology, including sort of social networking, has changed the world far, far more over the last two decades than anything in biology or medicine. Yet we hear this is the century of biology. No, not yet it isn't. Maybe it will be. Paul, what do you think? Why can't you inspire young people, given there are all these small-scale social entrepreneurs, not social entrepreneurs, young entrepreneurs setting up new companies?
Well, maybe it's a bit black and white. I mean, we do inspire a lot of people as an ICT community, and we see a lot happening, but it can be much, much better. Again, well, I'm not going to repeat my earlier remarks, but if we could get across an inspiring message about how we can build a smart society and what that means, and how we are not transmitting this cliche type of message of the nerdy people sitting behind a screen.
And a non-elitist, to pick up the questioner's word, a non-elitist message. He thought we were sounding elitist. Maybe we were.
Maybe. Yeah.
But anyway. Yeah. Anyway, it's a good point. Could you pass the mic down to the lady in the front? Sorry. Is it working? No. She'll switch it on.
Is it now?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, sorry. I'm working in the health sector, worked at different areas, industry, ministries, academia, and I'm involved in one of the flagship projects, ITFOM, the Future of Medicine, where I really see the bottleneck is that I never saw such not only a gap between basic science, the speed of basic science, and the policy making. And it's not only, I think, that it's really challenging policies, like it was mentioned, changing policies, I think it's really turning upside down the healthcare systems. So I think it's really important that that the basic sciences are linked to policies and finding creative solutions for policy makers in order to support that later. Otherwise, I think it's really a pity. The other thing is, the second point, that when I look back from the history of the European Commission, the focus, I think it was a very strong thing in the past when I think about Euratom and how it developed and so I think Europe can play a really leading role worldwide in focusing with such things like the flagship.
Robert, yes, you should reply to that.
I mean, I'm delighted, since before I did this job, I did health, when anybody asks about health. And the good news is, sitting in Budapest, that next week we are precisely doing what you call for, which is having an e-health conference, not in the same place, but just across the city, trying to build the links between the research agenda that the health and ICT budgets are funding in Europe, and the health professionals, and the patients' organizations, and it is, as the questioner suggests, extraordinarily difficult. And I think that both questions really go to the challenge that I, as a newcomer to the research field, feel to be the determining factor in the value added from research and actually in the license to operate for research, which is making the message understandable outside. And wherever outside is, wherever we feel the boundary of comfort falls, we have to go a step further. And I think that's true in decision-making fora. So there are lots of non-elitist members of the European Parliament who will decide the research budget next year and don't understand what FET is.
Yes.
And also in health professional areas, because picking it up, and the robots example is a great one. I mean, having the most wonderful robots in the world will only work when people in the care communities say, would you like a robot, Granny? And we're not there yet. So I think it's absolutely the right question.
Yes. Okay, because it's gone 1 o'clock, I'm going to ask our six panelists if they would like very briefly to sum up or give some concluding remarks different from their opening remarks. You want to start, Jacques? It's a very brief summing up.
To sum up between small research and large research, but also to sum up between ICT research and research in other fields, like was mentioned just before, I think the right picture is that the small research has to be funded. The first aim of research is advancement of knowledge. And for the rest, there should be some evolutionary process that makes new clusters appear that are different from traditional disciplines. And this could be also the aim of large programs.
Thank you.
Just one sentence. Promise yourselves when you get back to the office next week, you will do 1 hour's extra work for public funding of research in Europe before you go on summer holiday. I mean, I think this is the time when you have to do it.
What sort of work? Just
find your local politician and say, I want the European Union budget to spend a higher proportion on research after 2013.
Less on agriculture.
I didn't say that.
Norbert.
Two sentences. I think in connection with the time paradox, what I mentioned, this applies to the decision-making process too. So we have to try in Europe to increase the decision-making processes in scientific issues also. And the other one is, we have to get accustomed to the fact that research is a high-risk issue, so we have to accept the element of risk in all our research activities.
Thank you very much. Paul, yes, we'll go down the row.
All right. So big questions and big challenges require big projects. However, we should not see this as contradicting the effectivity of medium-sized and small projects. I think that's a phantom issue. It's not reality. I do believe that what Europe is doing right now is unique. It's amazing. We should support this very strongly, because I think to make progress also across Europe in integration, addressing these big questions, we need to have these large-scale integrated projects, even if we do not know exactly then as scientists or as policymakers how to do it. There's a lot of on-the-job training here. This is new for everybody. But because it is new, we should not be afraid of it. This is just a new method of developing and supporting science. It's novelty. Let's not be afraid of novelty. If we're afraid of this kind of novelty now, how afraid will you be about all these novel discoveries? So let's just move on. This is an incredible opportunity. It's great.
Thank you.
Well, I don't want to be original. I want to go 100 years back. 110 years ago, it was the birth of quantum mechanics. And that was a real revolution. Now we are talking about devices. Actually, almost all devices are quantum. And one of the fathers of quantum mechanics was Wolfgang Pauli. And in our community, something which is common is seminars. And it was a seminar. It was a young fellow who presented his theory at a seminar. And after that, he came to Wolfgang Pauli and asked, Professor, what do you think about my theory? And Wolfgang Pauli is quite known to be very witty, but also nasty. And you know what was his comment? I think that this is the message, especially to youngsters. My dear, it was most interesting, but not crazy enough to be true. So I wish your theories and your approaches be crazy enough to be accepted by the Commission.
I love that. Last word to you, Paul.
Well, thank you very much. I can't add many wise words to what have been said here, but my message still is about communication as the main vehicle. We as researchers, as ICT researchers, ICT-based researchers, should focus on communicating the value that we create for society much more than how clever we are. And to be honest, walking and seeing all the posters, I could indicate a couple of posters which talk about value, but a number of posters which talk about how clever we are. And I believe the message to society should be the value we all create. And we only can do that, I think, in close cooperation with other disciplines, working together, shoulder to shoulder. And that's why large projects, as a roadmap, or as you said, showing leadership and a visionary approach, is the best way to move forward.
Thank you very, very much. I'd like to thank all my panelists for their truly wise and very articulate remarks. Of course, it's both big and small, but above all, it's good communications within the scientific community and, as Paul said, to the outside world. It's now lunchtime. The parallel sessions will start at 2:30 this afternoon. The exhibition's now open, and Josh Bongard will open the scientific cafe at 2:00. Thank you all very, very much.